A stranger with a gun came upon two teens taking pictures under a rising full moon. But violence is only the beginning of this story.
Sometimes I thought, there are no miracles. Yeah, there are, and this is a big one.
I'm Amy Donaldson, and I've spent my career talking about how lives are undone by violence. The Letter is a podcast about how lives are remade. Follow The Letter at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
The headline over the weekend was former President Trump sending out a message through Truth Social stating that he believed he would be arrested this coming week based on a possible indictment coming from Manhattan's district offices. And so we want to get beyond the headline component to all of this and get to the deeper questions of, is this politics as usual in our country? Is the former president pursuing a political strategy or a legal strategy? Are Republicans chasing a grievance strategy when it comes to 2024? Are Democrats misreading the room? And is anyone asking what's best for the country? Let's begin.
Think you know the news of the day?
Think again.
So we want to get into this in several different angles. And again, I'm going to set the actual issue aside as it comes to the former president and hush money that was paid during the 2016 campaign that stemmed back to a relationship that was about 6 years before that. We can get into all of that as the indictment does come out or doesn't come out, and what was legal, what wasn't, and all of those things. I want to set that part aside for a second because I want to get at what this is actually leading us towards and what we should be concerned with as a country. And are we really getting to that ultimate question, what's best for the country? And who is willing to show the courage, political and otherwise, to do the right thing for the country? Because I think we're missing it in so many different ways. And so I want to start actually with the Republicans. And Republicans have been putting themselves in Gordian knots over what to say and what not to say as it relates to the former president and a possible indictment coming out of New York. During a press briefing yesterday, Speaker of the House Kevin McCarthy lays out the Republican defense of the former president against the allegations made by the Manhattan DA.
You can go through lawyer after lawyer after lawyer. We'll tell you this is the weakest case out there. Trying to make a misdemeanor a felony, the timeline doesn't work because it's too long past, and doing it after a person for political purposes.
The speaker went on to condemn this type of politically motivated justice or targeting and said he thinks the American people hate it too.
I think Republicans and Democrats alike hate this type of justice. It's supposed to be equal to all in America. And the last thing we want or have is somebody putting their thumb on the scale simply because they don't agree with somebody else's political view. That is what's wrong, and that's what infuriates people. And this will not hold up in court if this is what he wants to do.
Finally, Kevin McCarthy stated he didn't want protests to happen over the potential indictment and, of course, took a shot at the media, misrepresenting the former president's statement. Clearly, Kevin McCarthy, as Speaker of the House, is trying to tiptoe, as many Republicans have been, about what to say and what not to say as it relates to the former president.
I don't think people should protest this, no. I think the thing that you may misinterpret when President Trump talks, he's not talking in a harmful way, and nobody should. And this is why you should really make law equal, because if that was the case, nothing would happen here. And that is what has to transpire. Yes, ma'am. Have I spoken to who? No, I have not spoken to Trump.
Okay. Take a deep breath there. So many things in what the Speaker of the House was saying, and it's Gordian knots on steroids is what it really is for many Republicans, trying to not offend, sort of defend, not quite sure where you end when it comes to the former president. But here's what we have to get to. So yesterday's press conference with the Speaker of the House was coming at the conclusion of the Republican retreat, which is where they are supposed to come up with their agenda, their focus, their plan for the country to move forward. And I think that's what Kevin McCarthy should have been talking about yesterday. But instead, he spent an entire time focusing on, addressing, talking about the political implications and targeting and all the different things. And you can have that debate if you want to have it. But if you're the Speaker of the House, you got to just lay out your agenda and keep moving, because you're not the district attorney in Manhattan and you're not the advisor to the former president. You're the Speaker of the House of Representatives. So legislate. And it just so happens that you have a piece of legislation that is supposed to be introduced tomorrow. House Bill number one, which is supposed to be your highest priority. And it's all about energy, energy independence, moving from oil and natural gas to things that are cleaner and greener, and what that path looks like and how you can actually get there with some reform of regulatory regimes, dealing with lawsuits that can be filed. And this impacts green energy, wind and solar, as much as it does oil and gas. Those are all things that the American people can say, yeah, that's going to make my life a little better. It's going to make energy a little less expensive. It's going to make it more reliable and dependable. It's going to make sure that we're independent as a country, so we're not buying our oil and gas from thugs and bad guys and people who do it with child labor or do it in a way that's environmentally more harmful. But he didn't talk about any of that. Instead, he talked about the former president and a lawsuit, an indictment potentially coming out of Manhattan. I think that's a mistake. Now, if you continue on, it's this whole idea of grievance and this grievance mentality that actually has me really worried, because the Democrats are doing the same thing when it comes to grievance and grievance mentality. Meanwhile, on the political front, you've also got the former president who understands grievance probably better than any politician in the history of this country, and how to whip up a populist grievance mentality to win an election. The former president has already sent out fundraising emails about this potential indictment and arrest in New York. And guess what? The best thing you can do is chip in 10 bucks or 50 bucks or 100 bucks or 250 bucks, and you'll get a T-shirt and a hat, and it'll be great. So he's whipping up the grievance mentality. And interestingly, in the former president's home state of Florida, the governor there happens to be Ron DeSantis, who, of course, is toying with an idea of running for the presidency, most likely with an announcement coming in June after their legislative session. And now he's trying to dance through, and the former president is attacking Ron DeSantis for not having come out in his defense when it comes to the Manhattan DA.
We are not involved in this, won't be involved in this. I have no interest in getting involved in some type of manufactured circus by some Soros DA, okay? He's trying to do a political spectacle. He's trying to virtue signal for his base. I've got real issues I got to deal with here in the state of Florida. We've got so many things pending in front of the legislature. I've got to spend my time on issues that actually matter to people. I can't spend my time worrying about things of that nature. So we're not going to be involved in it in any way. I'm fighting for Floridians, and I'm fighting back against Biden. That's what I do every single day.
So a little bit of political jujitsu there from Governor DeSantis, talking about the weaponization of the courts, talking about George Soros-funded prosecutor in Manhattan, and trying to make that case that this is the Democrats. Also interesting, on a CNN interview over the weekend, New Hampshire Governor Chris Sununu has also talked about running for president. He has talked about how the Democratic Party might be misreading the room a little bit when it comes to the former president.
Well, again, I think there's a lot of unknowns. I can tell you, I think it's building a lot of sympathy for the former president. As you pointed out, this is likely some sort of misdemeanor on an issue 7 years ago. This has nothing to do with January 6th. I just think that not just the media, but really a lot of the Democrats have misplayed this in terms of building sympathy for the former president. And it does drastically change the paradigm as we go into the 24 election.
Really interesting insight there from Chris Sununu, governor of New Hampshire. Again, someone who's also thinking about running for president. And interesting that he's calling out some Democrats who are really making this the issue. But again, this is kind of a whole grievance thing. And that's just not a good conversation. Now, here's the real interesting insight of over the weekend. Other Democrats have been weighing in, giving their reaction, trying to walk that line in terms of not getting involved, but also calling things out. And really interesting, Jen Psaki on her new show on MSNBC gave her thoughts. And this is interesting about how the White House may respond if this all plays out this week.
When it comes to the reaction from the White House, my bet is you won't hear a lot about Trump's outbursts from them. They want to keep the temperature down, too. But behind the scenes, they're also paying close attention. Now, that's what they should be doing. But we should also be clear-eyed about exactly what Donald Trump is trying to do here. As his legal troubles mount, his goal is to manufacture outrage and direct it at the Manhattan DA.
So manufacturing outrage, watching that, how did that all play out, that grievance mentality. We're going to come back to that later in the show today because I think it's a problem that extends across the political spectrum and always keeps us a safe distance from the conversations we have to have for the good of the country. So we will watch this play out this week. But we're not going to chase the headlines in terms of who said what and why and who's mad at who and who's raising money off of this and how much of this is politics as usual. We want a different question. And so we're going to get underneath that as we look at how does this different kind of conversation come about? Is it possible? And what's our responsibility to make sure that it does?
With Lloyd Matheson on KSL News Radio.
A gun in the face.
Then all of a sudden they all kind of lined up. They pointed their guns at me. And this is the point where I thought, I'm going to die today.
Started 2 years of horror for an American in Venezuela.
They said, you need to give us your phone and get ready because you're coming with us.
I'm Becky Bruce, and I spent a year researching and piecing together Josh and Tammy Holt's story about their ordeal in a notorious prison.
That's when everything started to turn bad. We had another pound on the door. Boom, boom, boom. And there was the police once again.
You can binge all of the episodes of Hope and Darkness on KSLpodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Boyd Matheson divides rage from reason on Inside Sources.
Well, last week, Vladimir Putin was indicted for war crimes. The International Criminal Court issued an arrest warrant for the Russian dictator for deporting Ukrainian children to Russia. Over recent years, we've seen a shift towards holding leaders accountable. So what's the case against Vladimir Putin? And will the international community, including the United States, come together to present evidence and truly hold him accountable? We are really pleased to have joining us on the show today, Diane Orentlicker, a professor of international law at American University. Diane has often been described as one of the world's leading authorities on human rights law and war crimes tribunals. And Diane, I know this is a busy season for you, and we appreciate you carving out some time. So give us a little bit of the lay of the land in terms of what the indictment last week, these charges and this arrest warrant for Vladimir Putin, what it really is, and then we'll start marching. What comes next?
So first of all, we don't know all of the war crimes with which or other crimes that the prosecutor has in mind. The court itself made public the existence of an arrest warrant, but it didn't make public the arrest warrant. So there may be more allegations, but the one that was featured in the statement of the court was involved the war crime of deporting children. And there were two charges that both related to that offense. It's been a truly horrific set of offenses in a landscape of just staggering atrocities. But basically what has been very well documented is that the Russian government, and it's made no secret of this, has been abducting Ukrainian children and bringing them to Russia or to Russian-occupied parts of Ukraine and having them adopted by Russian families.
And so
this charge really puts a spotlight on that practice.
Yeah. And so obviously with that and others, as you mentioned, that may be included in this as it rolls forward. Give us the kind of the practical tacticals of it. What does come next? I don't think anyone is expecting someone to waltz into the Kremlin and handcuff Vladimir Putin and walk him out. What do you expect to see as this moves forward?
So one thing I would say is that a lot of the reporting has said that the news or the development was symbolic, because we don't expect to see Vladimir Putin in the dock anytime soon. And I would like to say that to the extent it's symbolic in that sense, it's hugely symbolic. It has not happened in a very long time that a sitting head of state, or in a long time, I should say, has been indicted by an international court. But it's never happened that a sitting head of state who is the head of state of a superpower country has been indicted by an international court. So this is really a paradigm shift. And it's not a step that a prosecutor would take lightly, because once you take that step, there are huge expectations that you will deliver, and that if you ever do get custody of the suspect, you'll be able to secure a conviction. So it was a momentous development last week for the prosecutor to go straight to the top in his first effort to get an arrest warrant. It's often the case that a prosecutor of an international court will start with lower level officials, senior officials nonetheless, but lower level, and then work his or her way up to the top. But the prosecutor of the ICC went straight to the top.
Yeah, so fascinating. And I love what you've pointed out in terms of the things that are unprecedented as part of this. And I agree with you. I don't think this is just symbolism here. I think there are a lot of things coming together. You had a great piece for NBC.com talking about for NBC News, talking about some of these things that have converged, including the Ukrainian president really weighing in, saying, look, he has to be held accountable for these war crimes.
Right. And I think that's part of why there's been so much international support for accountability. It's not going to be easy to literally get custody of Putin. That's a really tough one. I wouldn't rule it out someday in the future, but that's tough. But what I think is unusual is the amount of international support for investigative work. The U.S. Justice Department has been providing support very actively to Ukrainian prosecutors who are investigating hundreds, if not thousands, actually thousands of cases that it hopes to be able to prosecute in domestic courts, but it won't be able to prosecute Vladimir Putin or other senior officials. And so evidence will be, there'll be more evidence than you often see in a case like this. And these atrocities have also been documented in real time by the media, which President Zelensky has been very open to. He's allowed the media to investigate war zones and wartime atrocities without restraint, and that makes a big difference. So it means we can get evidence while it's fresh. It also means that there's lots of evidence because there are a lot of people investigating. In fact, one of the challenges is making sure that there is coordination among different actors who are looking into atrocities, but there won't be a shortage of evidence.
Yeah. And then finally, before I let you go, let's talk about the U.S. role in all of this, which has been a little bit complicated as it relates to the ICC and evidence and so on. Give us a little bit of the lay of the land there.
So the United States has had a complicated relationship with the ICC, as you said, and its policy has evolved and changed over time. But the policy currently is similar to what it was under the Obama administration, which is that a case-by-case determination is made about whether the United States will support the ICC's work. So there's not a blanket prohibition in general or a blanket support for every case. A determination is made each time about whether it's in the United States' interest to support an investigation. And then there are some legal restrictions which have eased recently that also that limit the type of support the United States can provide. But again, that landscape has changed as a result of congressional legislation in December. Despite that change in congressional legislation, which allows the United States to provide support in this case, there's still a policy debate within the administration about whether to provide certain kinds of evidence, at least, to the ICC prosecutor. And as the Times reported, the Pentagon opposes providing evidence, while other agencies are support giving evidence to the ICC.
Yeah, fascinating. We're going to continue to follow this. And Diane, we appreciate you jumping on a very busy day. And these are just the perspective is so great. Thanks for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
All right. So important as we look at how this plays out. And again, a lot of people have focused on the symbolic nature of this. Again, no one expects Vladimir Putin to surrender or for people to walk in and put the handcuffs on and do the perpetrator walk. We don't see that happening. But I do think that Diane is right in looking at the fact that there is a confluence of things that are happening that make this a little different. One, a sitting head of state, sitting head of state of a world superpower and nuclear power. I think those are very interesting elements to this. And then we will see all of it play out beyond the atrocities committed against the children of Ukraine. We know there's a host of other things that have taken place during the course of this invasion by Russia into Ukraine. And there does need to be accountability for that. How that comes about, we'll continue to watch. All right, we'll step aside for some bottom of the hour news. Much more to come on Inside Sources here on KSL News Radio. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
Well, early polls tracking the Republican presidential race are coming to similar conclusions. Ron DeSantis seems to be losing some momentum. And the interesting thing is, of course, Ron DeSantis, governor of Florida, has not officially entered the race, but many expect he will do that after their legislative session at the end of May. But he seems to have a bit of a problem on his hands, and I always call it the trying to please everybody, you make everybody mad syndrome, and he may be experiencing that. And to help us break down those early numbers, Carly Cooperman, of course, is a partner and CEO at Schoen Cooperman Research, someone we always look to help us get beyond the numbers. And Carly, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Great to speak with you.
So Ron DeSantis obviously has had a nice rise. He's kind of the popular counter to the former president right now. Mm-hmm. You've been tracking the numbers and watching that, and you're seeing some of that little bit of erosion there with the DeSantis camp. But what actually are you seeing?
Yeah, that's right. There's been about a dozen polls released in the last month that shows variations of either DeSantis against Trump in a two-way matchup among Republican primary voters or multi-field, multi-candidate fields where, you know, we're looking specifically at DeSantis and Trump in terms of how they match up against each other. And while there's a lot of variability in these numbers and, you know, questions maybe about the quality of some of the polls, there is undoubtedly clear trends that we're seeing across all of these polls. We see that DeSantis is slipping and Trump is gaining, and that's in both the two-way head-to-heads as well as the full field head-to-heads. So that's definitely what we're seeing. And, you know, there's a few factors that are going on right now that I think is contributing to this. First, the election bump that DeSantis got from the midterm elections is over. He received a tremendous amount of coverage after the midterms in terms of how strong his win was in Florida and what a resounding victory he had. And at the same time, Trump got a lot of negative coverage because of how bad overall Republicans did in the midterms, and specifically the candidates that Trump backed, you know, losing a lot of races that otherwise probably would have been winnable for Republicans. The second thing is that now Trump has gone on the offense. He's attacking DeSantis left and right and has been for the last 6 to 8 weeks. You know, he's using opposition research that he's getting, and he's coming on with these attacks. But to that end, DeSantis is on the sidelines. You know, he hasn't announced a candidacy, as he said, and he's not mounting a defense. He's not really firing back against Trump either. And it's a really tricky balance to play because he's seen, you know, that it can backfire if you're attacking Trump, but he's not really defending himself either because he's also not a candidate. So there's those three factors going on. But then the last point I'll make right now is that there's this bigger picture issue, I think, where, to your point about trying to please everybody, he's kind of trying to do two things at the same time. On one hand, he's trying to reach that far-right group that Trump has and be this alternate to Trump in this populist appeal. But on the other hand, he is courting the Republican establishment. He, you know, initially seemed to be the chosen favorite among the party establishment in terms of who they'd like to see as opposed to Trump. And it's very difficult to both be the establishment candidate and try to be the populist candidate once. And as a result, we're seeing Trump attacking him for being too much like an establishment, and then the establishment Republicans attacking DeSantis for some of the populist comments that he's making.
It is so interesting to see how that all shakes out there. One of the other things that was interesting in your analysis and some of that from your partner, Doug Schoen, is that looking at how you distinguish between your opponent, and I know DeSantis has sort of been, hey, I'm all the good Trump policies without the tweets and the negative baggage, and I can actually win. But that doesn't seem to be connecting with a lot of the Republican primary voters.
That's exactly right. And so, you know, his core argument is, you know, hey, I can be, you know, I can be just like Trump, except, you know, I'm more measured and more balanced, but I can actually win. And right now that is not sitting with Republican voters. You know, there was a CNN poll that came out recently where a majority of Republican-leaning voters, Republican-leaning independents also said that they're going to support the candidate who they agree with on their issues, rather than the one who has the strongest chance of beating Biden. The electability argument is very tricky because, especially with primary voters, and we see this on the Democratic side too, initially these voters care about issues, and it's sort of hard to tell them to put their issues aside and go with electability. But I do think that matters as you get farther along into the election to voters, and they think, you know, both towards the end of the primary and then once you get to the general, that argument matters, but right now it's not connecting with Republicans.
Yeah, and I wanted to get your perspective, Carly, on kind of the fray over the weekend. Of course, we have President Trump saying, hey, I'm most likely to be arrested next week based on you know, political stuff coming out of Manhattan. DeSantis, I think, wisely staying on the sideline of that one, not weighing in. Trump then using it as a fundraising email to say, look, he's not standing up for us and all of these awful, horrible, you know, Democratic things. How does that all play out? The argument of do you engage, do you not engage is one that's tricky, not just for Ron DeSantis, but for anyone taking on the former president.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly the epitome of the challenge that DeSantis is facing always, right? Because Trump is going to use this potential arrest to rally his base, you know, to continue these arguments that the Democratic-run government is out to get him. And it'll take attention away from DeSantis and to Trump, and it's going to be effective. And DeSantis both has to, you know, kind of stand up as the populist candidate to also be like, hey, this is wrong, but he doesn't want to give too much, you know, flattery to Trump. And so he actually did, I think, say something today about where he said that, you know, this was a political agenda and weaponizing the office of the DA, but, you know, also sort of made a little bit of a dig of Trump in doing so.
Yeah, I thought that was really fascinating to watch that. I want to ask you just really quickly before I let you go, Carly. One of the things that I have been trying to watch and get a sense of is the former president is really good at this idea of grievance and this kind of grievance agenda, which I think deep down just doesn't resonate. It's worked to win some elections, but I don't think the grievance thing really plays for the long haul. I think the fact that the House Republicans had a retreat to come up with a great strategy and spent their entire press conference talking about the former president and George Soros and weaponizing and all of those kinds of things rather than a positive agenda. What are you seeing from the numbers in terms of are we really headed for another round of grievance battle, or is this going to be an opportunity for a shift and get on to maybe a vision of where we're headed?
I completely agree with you. I don't think the grievance mentality is in you know, campaigning is really effective at the end of the day. And I think we sort of saw that with what happened in the midterms because, you know, one of the criticisms Republicans had is that they didn't really put forward an alternate approach on any of the issues where they were attacking Democrats for. So I certainly hope that as the primary season progresses, which is still very early, but, you know, and things go underway, that there is some substantive discussion about, you know, solutions and policy to these issues that are facing our country and, you know, that everyday Americans care about.
Yeah. Great insight as always. Carter Cooperman, partner and CEO at Schoen Cooperman Research, the place we always look to help us understand what is behind the numbers. Carly, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Great insight there from Carly Cooperman. I'm convinced that a grievance campaign is not a winning campaign. And if nothing else, you may win an election, but it doesn't mean you get to lead if you're basing it all on grievance. We'll talk about that a little bit more coming up later on in the show. But stay with us. We'll be back. More Inside Sources coming up next.
Boyd Matheson divides rage from reason on Inside Sources.
Well, there's some conversations that you just look forward to, and this is one we've been looking forward to for a long time. We have Brooke Walker joining us in studio. Of course, many of you recognize Brooke Walker as the host and executive producer of Studio 5 with Brooke Walker on our tag team partners at KSL TV. And Brooke, it's great to have you in here. And the topic we're going to discuss is one we love on this show. And yes, you're doing an amazing thing this week about your beautiful neighborhood. Tell
yes
us about it.
Yes. Well, first of all, I'm honored to be here. Am I on the Boyd Matheson show?
You are in.
Is that
you
happening?
Are so in.
I've arrived, Mom. I've arrived. No, grateful to be here, Boyd, and really excited about this topic. I know it's one that's near and dear to your heart, but we have really gone all in this week on Studio 5, the producing team, around this topic of neighborhood and community and the unity that we want to put back into community.
Yeah.
And so we've got a week-long series, and it's more of a movement, really, or we hope it will be. You'll be hearing daily conversations on Studio 5. You and I had a nice chat. We recorded
nice
this
chat
morning. That airs tomorrow. But different topics and facets around this idea of neighborhood. But there's also a week-long challenge that goes with it, and that's where the movement comes in.
Yeah.
Every day we're offering a small, doable, actionable challenge that we hope people will take on. And the purpose is kind of twofold. One, I think, is just to recognize and appreciate our neighborhoods for what they are.
Yeah.
And the second layer of that is possibly to kind of deepen not just that appreciation, but deepen that definition of neighborhood and maybe see it for the rich blessing that it can be in our lives.
Yeah, absolutely. And community matters. Neighborhood matters.
Yes.
It's where everything that important happens in our lives. We get so caught up on the big national things and the international things. It is neighborhood and community where it all happens. So we want to start. I want to make sure we get the challenge.
Yes.
In. What's the challenge?
Okay. Today, the challenge is to meet a neighbor you don't know. Or if you're maybe in one of those legacy neighborhoods where everyone knows everyone really well. And Utah's great at that.
Yeah.
I want to say Utah is a state that we can be proud takes this kind of challenge to heart. If you know all your neighbors, maybe get to know someone a little bit better or have a conversation, a different angle of a conversation you haven't had. That's today's challenge.
Awesome.
Which that's kind of a bravery inducing one. I mean, that takes a little courage sometimes to knock on the door and you don't know who's behind it. Tomorrow we're asking or inviting, I should say, everyone to do a silent act of service.
Love that.
For a neighbor. And that one I know is again, an area Utah shines in, is those silent acts of service. We've seen a lot of snow removal the last couple of months. We've seen those kind of service activities going on. On Wednesday, I'm super intrigued about this one. The challenge is to take a mindful walk around your neighborhood. So depending on the temperature, depending on the weather, it might be a quick little brisk one too. But take a lap and maybe just soak in your surroundings with new, fresh eyes. Like what's something you haven't noticed before that deserves your pause and appreciation? Or maybe you pick up on a need in your neighborhood that you haven't taken the time to otherwise see. But a mindful walk is the challenge for Wednesday. On Thursday, we want you to help a neighbor with their groceries. And groceries, it's funny. I mean, we're a female show on Studio 5, but there's been a lot of talk around the grocery store and what's not happening there anymore. We now pull up and pop our trunks and somebody puts our groceries in without a word and we drive off.
No eye contact.
Right. But that small talk, you and I touched on that
in
our conversation this morning, but that small talk and that connection that can happen in a place as simple and basic as the grocery store is part of our challenge this week. And then I'm looking forward to Friday's challenge as well, which is to post on social media bragging about your community. Do a brag post.
On your
what's something you love? What would you say? What would be a bragging point? If Friday's challenge comes around, what are we going to see you say on Facebook?
Well, our neighborhood, and we've talked about this on the show, we do a 1K donut run.
I love this so much. I want to move in.
The race is over before it starts, but everybody comes out. We raise some money for a good cause, and then everybody just hangs out and connects. The connection points are just fascinating for us to watch, and so I just love that about our neighborhood, and I just love this whole idea of having that brag moment. I think is an important thing. But all of these challenges. Now, one thing we do on this show is we like to throw out the triple dog dare.
Uh-oh.
Because when you get a triple dog dare, you can't not do a triple dog dare. So Brooke Walker has just given all of you the ultimate triple dog dare for your week.
There you go.
In finding either meeting someone you don't know in your neighborhood or getting to know someone a little bit better.
Right.
Then we've got the mindful walk.
Yes.
That's on Wednesday, right?
That's Wednesday. Tuesday. Tuesdays are silent active
silent
service.
Silent active service.
Yes.
And then Thursday's brag on your awesome neighborhood.
You got an A+ on that quiz. Well
there
done.
There we go.
Well done.
And you can find all of those on your social?
Yeah, there's a lot of conversation happening on the Studio 5 Instagram page primarily, but Facebook too, and all week on air. Weekdays, 11 o'clock on KSL.
Awesome. We may have you come back on Friday just to report
I
in.
I would love
because
it.
Because we believe in the Triple Dog Dare, and as we always end this show every day, it's see something that inspires, say something that uplifts, and do something that makes a difference. And Brooke Walker is helping us do that in our own neighborhoods, and there's nowhere better to do it. Sometimes we get caught in, I've got to do this to help, you know, this country that's in trouble or this area of the world that's in crisis.
The big scale.
We can do it right across the street.
Yes.
And right around the neighborhood. And I want to close out and go back to this idea of the mindful walk.
Yeah.
Around the neighborhood. I love that because I actually think that's biblical. I think it's the road to Emmaus.
Oh, there you go.
And I actually learned this from my dad. We had a thing where we had to pass out flyers to everybody in our neighborhood for a church event when my brother and I were 10 and 11 years old.
Uh-huh.
And in the old days where you had real mailboxes, and so we'd pull up and do that. I think we hit like 3 out of 4 mailboxes. But then this became a quarterly tradition with my brother and I and my dad. And as we would go around passing these flyers out every quarter in our neighborhood, he would talk about who lived in our neighborhood.
Yeah.
And that's really where the magic is. And I still remember that. It was just such a vivid thing of, wow, this family's dealing with cancer. And, wow, this family's got this opportunity to do something cool. Mm-hmm. And it just really changes your perspective.
I don't know. We're short on time, but I have a quick story. I moved into our neighborhood that we actually ironically just moved out of. It's just personal interesting timing with this series. But I remember the first week we were there. I said to my husband, we've got a creeper. There's a guy circling the neighborhood. And he was making me nervous. Every night I'd see him just lapping and looking and lapping and looking. And it was that following Sunday in church, he got up, kind of open mic, you know, testimony situation, and shared that, if you've noticed me working the neighborhood, don't be nervous. I'm a retired homicide detective. And I can't go to sleep until the neighborhood's been put to sleep. And there it was, like that mindfulness. And he said later that he would walk by every house and have kind of a pause, maybe a prayerful moment for him. But that pause of what's going on behind those doors? Is it the cancer or is it the, just that mindfulness of thinking who's behind those walls.
Yeah. Well, you should always start your day. Your day's always better if Brooke Walker is part of it.
Thanks, boy.
11 a.m.
Yes, sir.
KSL TV is always the place to be tuned in. So you can do that for your beginning of your day, then jump on at 1 o'clock to join us here.
We're a good tag team.
It's a perfect
tag team. It
should
be a campaign. KSL should get right on that.
We should get all over
Thanks,
that. So I want you to hit one last thing before I let you sneak out, because I know you have 27,000 other things to do in your day
You're
today.
You're top of my list right now.
What's the one thing that has surprised you as you've really kind of honed in on this idea of neighborhood and community?
I think the level of emotion that people are pouring into this topic, which is interesting because day to day it's just a surface, again, person over the fence. But the nostalgia and the trip down memory lane brings out such steeped emotion. And I think people are eager to bring that back, make sure their children have the kind of neighborhood they did growing up.
Yeah.
And so I think nostalgia is a really good driver. It's a good motivator. It's just figuring out how in our modern day of screens and technology and Facebook groups, how we can bring that same emotion and feeling back into the neighborhoods of today. That's kind of the puzzle piece this week that I hope to crack open.
Oh, it's so important and so good. So tune in all this week, 11 a.m. KSL TV. Brooke Walker, Studio 5, and just help us figure out this neighborhood thing. I think a lot of us recognize what we've lost. I think many people, especially coming out of the pandemic, still feel a little disconnected and discombobulated. And it's time to do that. And I love, love, love that you're doing this as a movement.
I
not
hope so.
As an episode.
Thank and, you. I hope so.
That makes all the difference in the world. Brooke Walker, we're so grateful to have you in studio.
Yes.
Finally, we got you in here.
I'm such a fan. I'm a listener and a fan. So nice to be here. Thank you so much.
Well, we're
going to
have you back. We're going to shoot for Friday if we
can
sneak you in.
Yeah, love it.
Just to do some report on what happened and what the experience has been, because I don't think there's anything more important in terms of our conversations, in terms of what is going on in our own neighborhoods, in our own communities. It is where the difference gets made every day. And so take those challenges, check them out on Facebook and social media as well, and be part of it. Be part of the story, because this is our story, and it only gets better when we all engage in it. Well, that wraps up hour number one of Inside Sources here on KSL News Radio. We'll step aside for some top of the hour news, but much more to come in hour number two, Inside Sources here on KSL News Radio. We'll be right back.
KSL FM Midvale, KSL Salt Lake City. Listen on the KSL News Radio app and in your car at 102.7 FM. KSL News Radio, Utah's all-day companion for news. Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
Of course, the headline today is President Xi is in Moscow for a high-stakes meeting with Vladimir Putin. That sends off all kinds of alarm bells and a lot of headlines in terms of what they are or aren't doing. My question is beyond the headlines, and is China looking beyond this? Are they playing a little bit more of a game of chess while the rest of the world's playing checkers? Let's begin.
Think you know the news of the day?
Think again.
As we said, all eyes have been on Moscow today with Chinese President Xi meeting with Vladimir Putin. And I think that's just one piece of the puzzle. I think there's so much to this where I really do think that China is moving beyond just economics and military and is really trying to have influence in many other places and spaces. And to help us discern all of that beyond the headlines, someone I always look to as it relates to China, Phelim Kine is a D.C.-based China correspondent for Politico. He's also the host of China Watcher and joins us on to help us break past the headlines there. And Phelim, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
One of the things that you have focused on, I'm going to jump right to this because I think it's the untold story beyond the headlines, and that is what China has done in the Middle East with Iran and Saudi Arabia. So walk us through that and then give us some perspective of how that plays into the meetings in Moscow today.
Yeah, I mean, what we saw just under 2 weeks ago is we saw Beijing broker a hostility reduction agreement between two really kind of historic foes. Iran and Saudi Arabia. And essentially, this deal allows them to renew diplomatic relations and just kind of turn down the temperature on the tensions in a way that benefits Beijing in the sense that, you know, Beijing relies a lot on hydrocarbons, petroleum, oil that flows through the Strait of Hormuz in that area. So it was a double win for Beijing, showing that it could actually project diplomatic heft and a diplomatic deftness to brokering an agreement between two foes, one of which is a longtime U.S. ally, Saudi Arabia. So it's really woken up a lot of people in D.C. in terms of how China is really branching out and how it's projecting its power globally.
Yeah, one of the things that we noted last week in that conversation with Iran and Saudi Arabia and China as the broker was the very subtle but very significant message to say we're not going to have these diplomatic talks between these three countries in English.
Exactly. I mean, this is part of paramount leader Xi Jinping's projection of Chinese power, which extends to currency, his efforts to get the renminbi, China's currency, to be accepted as an international currency, but also in terms of how Chinese language is used as in terms of international fora.
I think that's so interesting. And so now let's bring it full circle back to the Russia and China conversations today, and then ultimately how that impacts Ukraine. What does this mean in terms of China really flexing the muscle? As you mentioned it, or as you framed it, it kind of caused a few people to wake up a little bit in terms of what are they doing. Am I right in the assessment that it feels like they're playing chess and we're kind of reacting move to move, playing checkers?
Yeah, I mean, it's clear that this is China. This is Xi Jinping demonstrating to the U.S. that at a time when bilateral U.S.-China ties are really at a historic low, at a 50-year low, Xi Jinping is making his first foreign trip following the 20th Party Congress to Russia, a country that is waging this war of aggression against Ukraine, and basically a thumb in the eye of the Biden administration as the Biden administration attempts to sort of really bolster this international coalition of democracies against these two autocracies, China and Russia.
Yeah, and as you look at that, I was texting with someone who has some really high level experience in China and Russia, and just talking about where the U.S. is. And on one hand, we kind of just have the rhetoric stuff of, you know, we just need big defense and it's got to be a military thing, or we have the other extreme of this isolationist approach to what we should be doing as a country. And is it an element, or is this a moment? Is there an American moment in this where we can kind of reassert on the basis of freedom and liberty and upward mobility and opportunity? Because it seems to me that we're losing our edge in kind of the core principles that made us a global influence.
You know, there's something to that, but I think that we need to recognize that these two autocrats, these two leaders, Xi and Putin, are seeking sanctuary in each other at a time when they both, to a certain extent, feel cornered. Mm. When you have Russia, which has been punished, you know, grievously by sanctions, by isolation by the West due to its invasion. At the same time, Beijing provides it a lifeline in terms of hard currency that powers the war machine in exchange for fire sale prices on gas and petroleum. But these two leaders are, to a large extent, they're isolated and alone. And so they're seeking sanctuary and support with each other. And they have a message that doesn't really resonate. I mean, they talk the talk in terms of sovereignty, in terms of freedom and justice. But you take a look at what Russia is doing in Ukraine. You take a look at Beijing's expressed intentions toward Taiwan. You take a look at what Beijing is doing in Xinjiang against the Uyghurs. It goes on and on. So, you know, their rhetoric is fierce, but it's also pretty feeble when you actually test it.
That's a great point. And it is so interesting in looking around the world in terms of where China has been weighing in or trying to get the foothold by investing in places like Africa and some places in South America. I think that's an interesting component. And so here's the I've been saying this is one of those I wish I could be the fly on the wall days today. Anything you expect to see come out of the conversations between President Xi and Vladimir Putin? And do you anticipate anything significant in terms of a conversation with President Zelensky in Ukraine?
So I predict that Xi Jinping is going to come out of this conversation with Putin, that he's going to contact Zelensky in a way to sort of extend his role as a statesman and a diplomat based on what he was able to broker with Iran and Saudi Arabia, and offer and basically reiterate this 12-point program that Beijing rolled out last month that basically rehashes their existing positions on Ukraine, which doesn't criticize Russia, doesn't call for Russia to cease hostilities, doesn't call for Russia to withdraw, but basically says, everyone, like, let's stop fighting and let's talk without any type of preconditions. And that's going to go nowhere with the Ukrainians. But, you know, this is something that Xi Jinping is going to use to burnish his position as he's the peacemaker. He's not supplying weapons to either side. He's going to try to use it to draw a big contrast between the Biden administration, the United States, which China says is fueling the fire in the war, and they're trying to look like an honest broker and say, hey, everybody, let's just be peaceful. And that's not going to cut any serious ice with anybody who's paying any attention to this conflict.
Yeah, I know John Kirby came out very strong today saying that anything without a plan that includes Russia withdrawing from Ukraine is no peace plan at all. Secretary of State echoed very similar sentiments. Anything else you're watching for coming out of this? Any surprise elements or angles that they might try to leverage?
Well, I think that the longer term thing we need to be looking at is both Russia and China, Putin and Xi Jinping, see this Biden conception of the quote-unquote rules-based international order as a visceral threat to them and their regimes. And what they're trying to do is they're trying to cook up an alternate conception, an alternate bunch of organizations and entities and ideas and rules that they want to use to compete with that. And so you see that the Iran-Saudi Arabia deal, Beijing is branding that as a victory of Xi Jinping's global security initiative. They also have a global development initiative. They now have a global civilization initiative. These are all kind of platforms, ideological platforms that are inherently opposed to traditional universal conceptions of human rights, of freedom,
and really the foundations of the UN international system that we've enjoyed since the end of World War II. So we need to keep an eye on that, because there are takers for that in this world that we're in now.
Yeah. Oh, fascinating stuff. Phelim Kine, D.C.-based China correspondent for Politico. He's also the host of China Watcher, and someone we always look to help us get behind the headlines of what China is doing and the impact it has globally and right here at home. Phelim, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
All right. Some great perspective there from Phelim Kine from Politico. In terms of what we should be watching and how this plays out, I thought it was interesting that he noted that Putin and Xi are really finding kind of that solace between one another. And it looks fierce. It looks formidable. But he said when you really put it out there to the rest of the world, it's pretty feeble. And that's one of the things where I think they've been playing chess and we've been playing checkers. If we want to play chess, we should go boldly based on our principles and values, because that's what they fear the most. It's not our military. It's not sanctions. What they really fear is freedom. Freedom of expression, freedom of religion, freedom to pursue your own version of a dream and upward mobility and opportunity. That's what they fear the most. And we got to rely on that as our core strength, because then we can start playing chess and match them and make sure that the world remains free. We'll be right back.
With Lloyd Matheson on KSL News Radio.
Get deeper insights on the news from inside sources.
Well, yesterday marked the 20th anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. That decision was not carried out lightly, of course, and has had consequences that have affected many lives up to today. There was only one member of Congress who voted against the war, Representative Barbara Lee from California. The week after 9/11, Representative Barbara Lee gave a speech to Congress announcing her opposition to declare war against Afghanistan. And again, she was the only representative to do so. And I think her words are worth reflecting on today about the reasoning behind her opposition. Take a listen.
September 11th changed the world. Our deepest fears now haunt us. Yet I am convinced that military action will not prevent further acts of international terrorism against the United States. This is a very complex and complicated matter. However difficult this vote may be, some of us must urge the use of restraint. Our country is in a state of mourning. Some of us must say, let's step back for a moment. Let's just pause just for a minute and think through the implications of our actions today so that this does not spiral out of control.
I want to get to her closing remarks in that speech. Again, this was just 1 week after 9/11. She talked about her thoughts during the memorial service for those lost in the 9/11 terrorist attacks. Take a listen.
Now, I have agonized over this vote, but I came to grips with it today, and I came to grips with opposing this resolution during the very painful yet very beautiful memorial service. As a member of the clergy so eloquently said, as we act, let us not become the evil that we deplore.
Those were some pretty prophetic words from the Congresswoman. And now, of course, 20 years down the road, Congress has now begun the process to repeal the war resolution that gave legal authority for the president to begin the invasion. And the thing that we should be reflecting on today is, what's the legacy of the war? We need to look at that. And how do we go beyond just the big headlines of these kinds of things? I think one of the most important parts of all of this is this idea of this AUMF, this authorization for the use of military force, was really a moment where Congress abdicated its authority, its rightful authority, to declare war and to give that to the executive branch. And you could say in times of great crisis, that's not necessarily a bad thing. But the question is when we allow the crisis to become the standard and the norm, that's where I think we have to really pause and rethink. And I think part of what is going on right now in Congress is saying, you know what, we really ought to take that power back, because it is technically Congress's power to declare war. Senator Chuck Schumer, course, a Democratic leader of the Senate, announced the process for that in what they would do in terms of the AUMF, and that the Senate will be holding a vote soon regarding that resolution.
Yesterday, we took the first step to officially repeal the AUMF of 1991 and 2002, and tomorrow we will vote on cloture. Americans are tired of endless wars, and thanks to the folks here with me, this is the week the Senate will begin the process to end the legal authority that started the Iraq War two decades ago. March 19th will mark the 20th anniversary of that invasion. The Iraq War has been over for more than 10 years. The reality on the ground has long since changed, so laws on the books must change too.
Senator Tim Kaine also weighed in. He's been championing this effort for a long time now to revoke that AUMF, that authorization for use of military force. He gave his thoughts about the importance of taking this action this week in Congress.
Why is it important to do this? First, to reflect reality. We went to war against the nation first to push their troops out of Kuwait. That mission was accomplished. And then to topple the government of Saddam Hussein in 2002. That mission was accomplished. The enemy against whom we declared war in 91 and 02 is no more. There's no reason, none, to have a war authorization against a strategic partner.
He went on to highlight a troubling trend in Congress to abdicate their war power responsibilities to the president. That's what we've been talking about. He says this vote will be a step in reclaiming that responsibility.
A war vote is the hardest one you'll ever make. Could go wrong. So what Congresses have tended to do is defer and abdicate an Article I responsibility to the president, support the president when it works out well. When it doesn't, how dare you? But it's time for Congress to shoulder this obligation. And I think both Senator Young and I view having a vote like this on these outdated authorizations as Congress beginning to take back and occupy a little bit of that Article I responsibility.
You all know I have very strong feelings about Article I responsibilities and how often Congress has been abdicating those authorities to the executive branch. And this war power is one of those. And obviously we're in a very challenging, very volatile world right now. And if things are going to happen, and whether that's on a front like Ukraine and Russia, or whether it's somewhere else in the world, Congress has to be involved. That's the way it's supposed to be done. But Tim Kaine, again, a Democrat in the Senate, he pointed it out. He said, look, it is way easier for members of Congress to just abdicate this with this authorization to use military force, AUMF, than it is to actually do the hard work and heavy lifting of having a vote on a war. Because it's way easier to just say, well, you know, the president had authority to do that. And then if things go well, you jump on board, run to the front of the parade and say, well, of course, we were all supportive of that. And if things go south or if things get challenging or uncertain, and then you can start taking shots at the president, well, the president shouldn't have done that. That's Congress's job. And members of both political parties have done this over the years. And it is time. It is time for Congress to reclaim that authority. Because we have a host of places around the world where hard decisions will have to be made. And the people elected by the people are the ones who should make the decision, and they should be held accountable for it. They need to be involved in it and not just say, you know, don't yell at me. Don't yell at me. I just said the executive branch. I just said the president could do it. Not my job. And we've seen this in so many other ways. We've talked about this in terms of regulation and even many of the laws where Congress will pass a beautifully sounding law. It's got a great acronym. Everybody cheers. But then when it starts to get implemented by an agency and constituents start to go to a member of Congress and complain, and they say, well, you know, I voted for clean air. I voted for puppies. If you have problems with the implementation, you have to go talk to the agency because they're the hard people. They're the difficult people. And it's not right. It's not fair to those who are doing good work in those agencies. But it's an abdication of authority. And if you didn't want the job with your name on the door, you shouldn't have run for the job that put your name on the door. And Congress has to do its job. And this is one area where I think we're closer to getting it right if Congress will reclaim their authority under Article 1. All right, we'll step aside for some bottom of the hour news. Much more to come on Inside Sources here on KSL News Radio. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
We're thrilled to have back in studio today Amos Giora from the University of Utah, and he's been our eyes and ears in Israel, has come back here to the state of Utah. As we've continued to follow this mess, this unhingedness, I think is the new term in Israel, looking at how Benjamin Netanyahu has been looking at really dismantling the judicial system. And Amos, give us an update in terms of where things are there in Israel.
So, Boyd, as always, it's a pleasure to be here and to be in studio and to see Bella again. It's literally an hour-by-hour story that's breaking. Every hour, there's something new happening. I would imagine for the foreign media to try to keep up with this is all but impossible. The Israeli media is also obviously having challenges. But what's clear is that as an important Israeli journalist, Amir Oren, wrote 2 weeks ago in our New York Times in Haaretz, he wrote that Netanyahu prepared for the last war and not this war. Mm. And I think that's 100% correct. I don't think that Netanyahu and his inner circle, which is primarily his wife and his child, son, they did not expect that there would be over 500,000 Israelis every Saturday night demonstrating in over 100 different cities. Yeah. If you do the numbers, there are 10 million or 9 million Israelis. 20% are Israeli Arabs who unfortunately are not participating in this. 15% are Orthodox that are obviously not participating in this, which then means, I'm not good at numbers, but it means 65% out of 9 million can be participating. If 500,000 plus are demonstrating every Saturday night, that's a lot of people.
Yeah.
And the resistance, it's called the resistance, is incredibly organized. It's beyond sophisticated usage of social media. I'm sure books will be written about this. Today's Monday, Work Week in Israel began yesterday, and the government is in a real rush because it wants to finish legislating before Passover, which is in 2.5 weeks, yeah, for all kinds of various logistical reasons, because then the parliament goes into a recess for a month because of Jewish holidays. They would like to have everything done before Passover. They're in a real rush, but they're also clearly cognizant of the fact that X percentage of the public is literally up in arms.
Yeah.
And there are examples of not only of reserve soldiers refusing, of the high-tech industry in opposition, of investors pulling out significant money, of special ops reservists. There's a difference between regular soldiers and special ops. Special ops reservists, as of yesterday, no longer come.
Yeah.
That has an enormous impact.
Yeah. I want to get to something that you cued us in on last week from Israel when you were there, talking about this kind of the balance of power, this very unique and very tenuous coalition that Benjamin Netanyahu has put together that really seems to be kind of the core of whether they can continue this dismantling of the judicial system or whether the unhingedness begins to end.
So Netanyahu's government is comprised, like any parliamentary government, it's a coalition. You got to cobble together. There are five parties. There's Likud, which is his party, which is the largest partner. There are two right-wing religious extremist parties and then two Orthodox parties. The Orthodox parties are in this because he's paying them off because all they care about is money for their schools and their way of life. The two extreme right-wing parties are with him because he, in essence, promised them all kinds of measures, particularly against Israeli Arabs. But he's got his Likud party, all the efforts to convince the unhingedness, is that a word, unhingedness?
It is now.
It is, to stop, is focused on four or five different members of his own party and to convince them to indicate that they will vote against the legislation or to convince Netanyahu to modify the legislation or to stop it. And the entire focus, all this unbelievable effort, it's extraordinary to watch 500,000 people.
Yeah, and you told us last week that there was really specific around five particular individuals there that really could end up tilting that balance of power.
The entire effort is focused on these five. Last week, one spoke up at the beginning of the week, and then another one spoke up. Yesterday, another one spoke up. And then if you want to talk about the person, right.
We always talk about the room where it happens. Right. And Amos, we know that you have been in the room where it happens with one of these particular members that really could.
He could be the tilt.
Could be the tilt.
Right. So as you know, I served for 20 years in the Israel Defense Forces, including as the legal advisor to the Gaza Strip. While serving as a legal advisor to the Gaza Strip from 1994 to 1997, the commander of the Gaza, one of the commanders of the Gaza Strip, he was a one-star general at the time, was a guy named Yoav Gallant. And Yoav, when he was the commander of the Gaza Strip, made the decision that I, as his legal advisor, in all meetings will have the last voice before Yoav's voice, before he speaks. And also, when there's an operation, I will be in the jeep with him. Absolutely extraordinary in terms of commander, legal advisor relationship. I also happen to really like Yoav personally. I need to add that also. In the past 10 days, as you know, along with a friend of mine who's a professor of political science at the Hebrew University, we wrote in Hebrew and had to translate into English a 200-word, 300-word statement about the enabler. Drawing on my research, and I need to add, because we're in Utah, we put Representative Brian King's name, and that's enough. Brian is well known in Israel. He probably wins the Israel vote. And we had no idea when you post something on Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, you know, what kind of impact it has. And to our amazement, that statement, which calls Yoav and others out, has been read by demonstrators standing outside his house. It has been adopted as the motto by some of the resistance movements. And then it's 9:30 in the morning here. So a couple hours ago, it was made known through the media that Gallant told Prime Minister Netanyahu that if this doesn't stop, he will resign. And he's not a mere member of parliament. He is the defense minister. And to have a defense minister threaten to resign potentially could be, I don't want to be, you know, get caught up in the language. Could it be a game breaker? I don't know. Can it be significant? Yes. Does it cast doubt on all of this? Absolutely, yes.
Yeah. Well, in situations like this, we're always looking, it's always a tipping point moment. And you never know what that thing that is going to be that causes that tipping point moment to cascade into all kinds of things. And as you said, this has been an hour by hour effort over there in Israel. And so as you project it forward, to me, this is just stunning that suddenly someone is stepping forward, defense minister, saying, hey, wait a minute, we need to rethink and recalibrate. That's no small thing.
It's no small thing. And there's another person who in the world of, I can't make this up, who I also worked with, who became ultimately the head of our security agency, the Shabak. He's in many ways the next target. Will he cave? Will he change? I don't know, because he has his own ambitions. But the fact that the defense minister has made it very clear to the prime minister that this can't continue, you know, one has to be cautious. A million different things that can happen to Israel, but it is a significant cause for optimism.
Yeah, and that's such an important thing as we look at that. And in any liberal democracy, anywhere where you have a republic of any form, that separation of powers is the ultimate balancing element in terms of those who do want power or to have that authoritarian power. And so this is an important stand. This is I know this is seems far away to many of our listeners, and Israel's on the other side of the planet, but this is something that impacts freedom around the world.
I couldn't agree with you more. As I was smiling as you were speaking, because in the world of, you know, there are no degrees of separation in Israel, the person who's considered to be now the lead candidate, if indeed this goes forward, to be the what we call president here in America, Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, also served under me.
Oh. this is why we have Amos Giora as our ultimate inside source when it comes to Israel. We appreciate you coming. I know you've been traveling. You're going a million miles an hour, and I know you're sleeping in all the way until 3 a.m. On most days, and we appreciate you carving out some time for us and getting us up to speed, and we'll look forward to continuing the conversation real soon.
When I say 24/7, you know what I mean.
That's Amos Giora from the University of Utah, and he gives us such a unique perspective of what is going on in Israel. He was actually there last week. He participated in some of the marches, the protests that were taking place across the country. And again, the issue at stake is the Netanyahu government is looking at a, quote, reform package that would really change the dynamic and the balance of power and the separation of power as it relates to the Israeli Supreme Court. It would basically give Congress the ability to vote by a simple majority to overturn things that have been decided in the courts. And obviously that has created all kinds of outrage and frustration amongst the Israelis. And so there is a very interesting conversation going on. President Biden has weighed in a very strong way. He spoke with Benjamin Netanyahu saying, yeah, you got to dial this back. You've got to look at these reforms in a very different way. And then as Amos Giora pointed out, there are a few key members who are part of the governing coalition.
And it's such a narrow majority that if any of them pulled out, the whole thing could come tumbling down, and it could trigger another election cycle in Israel. We've seen a lot of those over the last several years. But this is one that is super significant, because I believe that balance of power, that separation of power between the judicial branch and the executive branch, whether it's here in the United States or whether it's in Israel or other democracies around the world, it really matters. And the path to authoritarianism begins by someone being able to overrule the courts with a stroke of a pen or a simple majority vote. And so we really appreciate Amos Giora from the University of Utah weighing in, giving us that perspective, that insider information. He really has been in a lot of the rooms where it happens as it relates to where things are in Israel. And we will continue to follow that. It's going to be a very important week there in Israel. We'll watch it. We'll have Amos come back and help us dissect it as we get past the headlines and see what's really happening there. All right, we'll step aside for one last commercial break. When we come back, final thoughts on a Monday on Inside Sources. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Hear elevated conversation on crucial issues. Boyd Matheson on Inside Sources.
Welcome back to Inside Sources here on KSL News Radio. It is great to be with you today. I am Boyd Matheson. And as we round out the show today, I want to go back to a conversation we started earlier in the program with our friend Brooke Walker from KSL TV and, of course, Studio 5, 11 o'clock every day. Weekday there on KSL TV, and she is doing this great movement, not a moment, not an episode, not a segment of the show, something she's really pushing forward, and that is Your Beautiful Neighborhood. And it's so interesting to me as we look at neighborhood and community, we always talk about it in the context of what we've lost, what we used to have in terms of neighborhood and community. And we often talk on this show about how important it is. It's where everything happens and why those local elections are so incredibly important. But sadly, we've become so disconnected, even in our own neighborhoods. And Brooke Walker is attempting to do something to bring back some of that connectedness. That connective tissue is so important. And she's doing a series this week, rolling through Your Beautiful Neighborhood and giving some specific challenges for us. And I want to go back to the challenges, because that's always where we end this show, is with some very specific things that we can do, some action that we can take to actually make a difference and move everything forward. And as it relates to our community and neighborhood, I love the things that Brooke Walker has come up with. And so I want to hit those. So the first challenge, and we're throwing these down as triple dog dare challenges on this show because that's what we do. So the first triple dog dare is to get to know a neighbor you don't know, and to just go spend a couple minutes and get to know them. And if you live in a neighborhood where you do know everybody, there's got to be someone that you know a little less well, and just go engage. It's a great opportunity to reach out and connect there in a unique way. The second challenge that I love as they go through the week this week on Studio 5 is silent service. And this is something I think we do extraordinarily well in the state of Utah. But just go out and do something in secret. Just go do a little secret service for somebody in your neighborhood. And the benefits of that will be great for whoever you serve, and they'll be even greater for you. Your day will be better, your week will be better, your month will be better, and you'll have made a difference for somebody in the process. And this is the thing that I love to describe as being in the fingerprint business. I love people in the fingerprint business. They're always out there making a difference, touching people's lives, encouraging, getting people to different places. And they do it without any fanfare. There's no focus on them. And it always comes back around. They just have these really light fingerprints. And I love the people in the fingerprint business in my neighborhood. And we have many in my neighborhood. And they know who they are. And they know that I know who they are. Because they leave their fingerprints all over the place. And if you're not looking, you don't see them. But if you get it, you get it. And you'll see they make such a difference without, again, without any fanfare, without calling attention. They're just out there making a difference. And leaving fingerprints on people's lives is actually the most lasting thing you will ever do. And you may not even know about it. But it may be 20 or 30 years later, and that little fingerprint you left on somebody's heart or in somebody's life is going to come full circle. And that is the magic of community and neighborhood. She also challenged us to do a mindful walk of your neighborhood. And this is a something I learned when I was really young. I shared in our previous segment with Brooke Walker. We talked about just walking the neighborhood, but doing it in a mindful way. And I actually learned this from my dad. When my brother and I were young, I think we were 10 and 11, it was one of those moments where something needed to be delivered to every mailbox in the neighborhood. And it had an announcement for a church activity. And it was too late to call anyone out. So my dad, of course, just grabbed my brother and I and said, we're going to drive around the ward and we're going to put all these flyers in these mailboxes. And we proceeded to do that. And everyone in our neighborhood had their own mailbox. And I think we probably hit three out of the first four as we were driving around. And I don't know if my dad's driving got better or if we got better hanging out the window. But we started doing this. And this became a quarterly activity for us. We do it every few months. We went back out, delivered this next set of flyers. And it became an educational piece for my brother and I as my dad would take us on a very mindful walk around our neighborhood. And he would tell us about the families that lived in our neighborhood and their strengths and their unique abilities, their professions and talents. He'd also share with us those that were struggling with big health concerns or a family crisis or some other difficulty that was going on. And it became the most instructive things that I think I've ever done with my dad and my brother as we learned to see our neighbors in a very different way. From a biblical standpoint, we often refer to it as our road to Emmaus, where we just went with my dad and we were just taught in a very different way. And so I love that challenge from Brooke Walker in Studio 5 to take a mindful walk of your neighborhood and just pause. Look at the houses. Think about the people who live in them. Think about the difference they make in your community and neighborhood. Think about the challenges that they may be facing. That'll change your world and your perspective in a heartbeat. And it will leave a really lasting impression there. And then the final challenge, which I also love from Brooke Walker, is to brag on your neighborhood, on your social media page. This is probably the best use of social media that we've had in a very long time, is just go on your social media page, whatever, which one you want to choose, and just do a very humble brag about how awesome your neighborhood is. We need a little bit more of that neighborhood and community pride. A lot of times President Biden gets razzed by the media and even members of his own party, and definitely from the Republican Party, as he talks about his growing up in Scranton. And a lot of people make jokes and say, oh, here goes the president talking about Scranton again. But I have to tell you, I may disagree with the president on some policy issues. I actually love it when he talks about Scranton and talks about his dad and what he learned and talked about what they talked about around their kitchen table or talking about one of his friends growing up in the situations that their family faced. I think that's a healthy thing. I think it's a good thing. I hope President Biden doesn't stop. I always learn something. I always learn something unique and different. You can get past all the politics and the campaigning side of all of that and just listen to it in the context of, what would I brag on my neighborhood about? Or my community, places that I've lived, people that I've lived next to, and people that I would call my neighbor. And that really leads us to an interesting part of our discussion as Brooke Walker and I were going through this conversation, looking at your beautiful neighborhood. And again, you can check that out on KSL TV all week on Studio 5 at 11. You can check that all out. But the thing we kept coming back to, of course, was the ultimate in neighborhood, which was Mr. Rogers' neighborhood. And all the lessons that all of us learned from Mr. Rogers in terms of who are the people in your neighborhood and how do you know them and what do they do and what is the difference that they make? What is it that makes them unique? And why is that a blessing and a benefit to all of us? And I think one of the most important things that Mr. Rogers taught all of us to do was to look. He taught us to look for the helpers. When we were scared or nervous or in the middle of a challenging or difficult situation, he taught us to look up and to look people in the eye. And how often have we lost that in our society? We're so focused on our phones these days that most of us spend most of our day looking down rather than looking around or looking up. And I think that has a big impact. And so of all the things that we talk about on this show every day, we covered the full gamut today, from a potential indictment of a former president to a battle for separation of powers in Israel, meeting between China and Russia, and a host of other challenges around the world. It really all comes back to neighborhood and community. Make your part known today. All right, that wraps it up for Inside Sources here on KSL News Radio today. And as always, as you go out into the world, make sure you see something that inspires, say something that uplifts, and do something today that makes a difference.
KSL FM Midvale, KSL Salt Lake City.
Listen on the KSL News Radio app and in your car at 102.7 FM.
KSL News Radio,
Utah's all-day companion for news.
A stranger with a gun came upon two teens taking pictures under a rising full moon. But violence is only the beginning of this story.
Sometimes I thought, there are no miracles. Yeah, there are, and this is a big one.
I'm Amy Donaldson, and I've spent my career talking about how lives are undone by violence. The Letter is a podcast about how lives are remade. Follow The Letter at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.